So Far from the Bamboo Grove by Yoko Kawashima Watkins, Chapter 11. In a small farmhouse near the 38th parallel lived Mr. and Mrs. Kim and their boys, He Cho, 16, and He Wang, 14. They were having supper when there was a loud thud outside the kitchen door. "Probably the wind," said Mr. Kim, eating his fluffy rice with kimchi, the hot Korean pickle. "The snow has changed to a blizzard." "He Cho, go check," said Mrs. Kim. The thin wooden door was usually easy to slide open with a toe, but this time He Cho could not move it. The door was off the track, and he tried to put it back. "Something is pushing the door," he called. "Maybe the wild boar again." Mr. Kim got up and went into the earthen floor kitchen and picked up a large broad axe. He Wang came with a rope, and Mrs. Kim brought a lantern. Mr. Kim gave his elder son the broad axe while he worked on the door. He could not get it back on the track. Mr. Kim thought the wild boar would be pacing about the barn, not pushing against the door. Finally, he lifted the door and removed it completely from the track. Wind and snow blew in, and Hideo lay there, unconscious. Mr. Kim touched his garments, frozen. They carried Hideo in and put the door back on the track while the wind howled and the snow blew in. The boys brought straw and mats from the barn and made a bed on the dirt floor. Mr. Kim removed the rucksack, and Mrs. Kim tore off the thin, torn Korean garments. A Japanese student's uniform appeared. "Is he a Japanese boy, father?" asked He Wang. "The way he carried his rucksack and the cherry flower emblem on the buttons of the uniform show he is Japanese," his father told him. They took off leg wrappers, shoes, and wet socks. Hideo wore four pairs of socks, half frozen, and all the shirts he owned. Mrs. Kim wiped his body and massaged his chest. "Look what I found," exclaimed He Wang, "a belly wrapper with a notebook in it." The notebook was a Japanese savings book. "What's his name, son?" asked Mr. Kim. Both of his boys could read the characters for Kawashima. They hid the savings book and the contents of the rucksack in case the Communist Army came to inspect the house. Mrs. Kim put more wood in the clay firebox that heated the cooking vat and the rest of the house. While the men massaged Hideo's legs and body, Mrs. Kim put crushed hot pepper in dry socks, put the socks on Hideo's feet, and wrapped the feet in the little fur coat. More crushed dry pepper went onto Hideo's chest as the massage continued. They put a nightshirt on him, covered him with a blanket, and tucked lots of straw over and around him. "He will be all right while we eat," Mrs. Kim said. As they ate, the farmer made his decision. "If he should die, or if anyone finds out we have rescued a Japanese boy, we will be betrayed for prize money and executed. Listen, everyone. The boy is going to be my nephew. His parents were killed by Japanese, and he has come to live with us. Do you understand? This way, we are not in danger." They ate quickly, and then Mrs. Kim crushed the garlic, added warm water, and tried to feed Hideo as Mr. Kim forced open his mouth. His throat contracted. He swallowed. His feet were warming a little, but his hands were ice cold. Crushed pepper went into mittens for his hands. Long after their sons had gone to bed, Mr. and Mrs. Kim massaged Hideo's body, kept water boiling for steam, and fed him garlic water with crushed hot peppers in it. Mr. Kim was feeding logs into the fire when his wife called out, "Aboji! Daddy!" He turned and groaned. Mr. Kim rushed back and patted Hideo's cheeks. Honorable brother returned to life, so tired that he could not move. He did not know where he was or who these people were, and where were his things. He was even fearful of being poisoned when the woman held a spoon to his lips. She tasted the pepper and garlic water to show him it was safe, and the hot mixture felt good to his stomach. He told them who he was and where he had come from, and He Cho, when he came home from school, told him, "You are going to be our cousin." Of course, Hideo wanted to be on his way to Seoul, but he was in no condition to travel. Besides, Mr. Kim told him, everyone trying to escape to the south had been killed by the Communist Army. "Now you are our relative," the farmer said. "Stay with us until you regain your health. You will be at home here." As soon as he was able to get up, Hideo helped the family, weaving straw, repairing the barn. Often he went to town with Mr. Kim to sell the straw mats they made. After supper, he would fetch two wooden buckets of water on a pole across his shoulders to fill a large tub in the kitchen so Mrs. Kim would not have to walk on the icy path. He got up early to build a fire and heat water. He helped He Wang with arithmetic and discussed politics with He Cho in the Korean language. He learned a political vocabulary. Spring came. Hideo helped remove the protective straw from the apple trees, and as the fragrance of apple blossoms filled the air and bees danced from blossom to blossom, his thoughts drifted to his birthplace, Aomori, in Japan, where lots of apples were grown. Then the images of his parents revived in his heart, for they too were born in the apple blossom country. Homesickness for his parents and sisters overwhelmed him, and one evening as they ate supper, he told the Kim family he must leave. "Stay, become our boy," said Mr. Kim. "Please stay," begged He Cho and He Wang. Mrs. Kim was in tears. "But he must go," Hideo said, "as soon as the spring work was finished and when the moon was dark, so that he would not be spotted." When the last supper with the generous Korean family was finished, he gathered his few belongings. His student's uniform, underwear, pants, and socks were washed and folded by Mrs. Kim. Hideo put the fur coat in the bottom of the rucksack, then the family album and savings book, then his clothes. Mrs. Kim packed large rice balls in a bamboo box, and Mr. Kim handed Hideo a little money. Hideo tried to refuse the money, for Mr. Kim was a poor farmer who had to give almost all of his earnings to the government, but Mr. Kim insisted that he carry some Korean money. He wanted to tell Mrs. Kim many things to express his gratitude, but the tears came and his chest tightened. Mrs. Kim held his hands and cried, "Ayago," an expression of sadness. He shook hands with Mr. Kim, and the hand, rough from years of hard work in the fields, seemed gentle and soft. Mr. Kim, in tears, bit his chapped lips and nodded his wrinkled face as if to say, "Don't say anything. I understand." Then, because a rucksack would give away the fact that he was Japanese, Mrs. Kim put the rucksack in a burlap bag, tied with a long rope, and told him to carry it around his hips like a Korean. He Cho went with Hideo as far as the river. Imojan, the fourth largest river in Korea, crosses the 38th parallel. American soldiers controlled southern Korea, and Hideo knew he would be safer once he crossed this boundary. The river was 4 miles from the Kims' house. As they left the house, the sun was about to set. Hideo kept looking back, waving to Mr. and Mrs. Kim and He Wang. Just before they vanished into the deep forest, he waved a towel 3 times for a final farewell. At their doorway, the Kims waved back. The river was well guarded by the communists. From a watchtower nearby, a searchlight swept over the area, throwing its strong beam on the river surface. Hideo untied his burlap bag and took off all his clothes, even his rubber-soled tabi. He shoved them all into the bag, put the bag on his head, and fastened it to him with the rope. That way, if the bag fell off his head, it would still be tied to him. He cast his eyes onto the dark, wide river and wondered if he could swim across. The thought flashed through his mind that if he was spotted and killed, this running water would be crimsoned by his blood. The boys looked at each other. They shook hands. He Cho whispered, "Cho Sim, Haiseo Kaseo, go carefully." "Koma Pusim Nida, thank you," whispered Hideo. "Shafi Janko Kaseo, travel so that you do not get caught. Unarul Ichi An Gusimina, I will not forget your kindness. Chigum Kaseo, go now." When the searchlight had passed over them, Hideo slipped into the river. It was much colder than he had expected, and the current was very strong. He swam. Each time a light came toward him, he dove under, so that only his bag showed, half submerged and looking, he hoped, like a floating log. Again and again he had to dive. Gunfire burst in the air, echoing in 1,000 directions. Hideo did not know whether it was aimed at him or some other escapees, or at a wild animal. The light swept over him again, and he submerged deeper. He could see the shore, not far from him, but the current kept pushing him downstream, and so many submergings slowed him. Again gunfire. A bullet hit the bag on Hideo's head and dropped to the surface. He could hear the bullets piercing the water all around him. He dove deeper and let the current carry him. Then he swam again. When he finally reached the south side, he lay as dead when the light shone his way, then crawled towards the bushes, exhausted. He had escaped across the dangerous 38th parallel. He took a deep breath of freedom. He thanked God for the Kim family and hoped that they would see in a dream that he had made it to the other side. His Korean clothes, protected by the fur coat, blanket, and the family album, were only damp, and he put them on. He had been carried so far by the current that he did not know his direction, so he spread his wet blanket and slept. The sky was bright when he woke. He ate one rice ball filled with kimchi, the Korean pickle that he had liked so much. As he ate the hot, garlicky pickle, he remembered reaching the Kim's house in the blizzard and being returned to consciousness with Mrs. Kim there. He had been saved, one step from death, and now he was no longer afraid of getting caught or being shot. He walked joyfully, eagerly searching through the bushes to locate the road. At a farmhouse, he asked directions to Seoul and took fast steps towards the city. He still carried that burlap bag around his hips, and for some reason he did not want to carry a rucksack as a Japanese boy should. Perhaps he wanted to follow the Korean custom as a sign of love for Mrs. Kim. He walked about 40 miles. In Seoul, he went straight to the railroad station, where Mother's note had said she and her daughters would be waiting, but he did not see his loved ones. He asked station workers, but so many Japanese women had come by with their children that they could not help him. For 7 nights, he slept in a corner of the station, searching for his family during the days. He began to wonder if they had been killed. Then he went to the American Red Cross, which was now helping Japanese and Korean escapees. The Kawashima name was not listed in the register of refugees. Maybe they had been lucky enough to get back to Japan. He asked for a certificate as a refugee so that he could get on the train to Busan and then on the boat to Japan. For the first time in 8 months since he had first left Nam, he was riding. It was a flat car on a freight train so filled with escapees that there was little space for him to sit. But he was just so glad that he did not have to walk. As the train began to move, he gazed absently at the station poles, not knowing that on them were messages carved by his sisters. Hideo, we wait at Busan. At Busan Harbor, the boats periodically made their runs to Japan with refugees. Hideo landed at Maizuru and discovered his name written on a piece of newspaper with his sister's address. He shouted for joy, "Little one's writing." Though it was a harsh winter for Ko and me, the reunion with Corporal Matsumura made our lives more bearable. He and Mrs. Matsumura often sent us packages containing leftover materials, threads, dried fish, pickles, and rice. The corporal even took orders from his clients for kimono garments and asked Ko to make them. Though he lived many miles away, each time a package or letter came, we felt he was near. He never failed to enclose stamps and asked us to tell him all our doings and about our progress in learning. One day he wrote to say he had put Father's and Hideo's name on the nationwide broadcasting station called Search for Persons. He told us to listen at 10 a.m. weekends if we were home and at 6 p.m. weekdays. We asked Mr. Masuda for permission to listen at 6 p.m. Holding hands, we stood in front of the radio. I even looked up at the radio on its shelf as if to listen to the corporal speaking to me. At 6, the announcer opened the program. Holding hands more tightly, we waited for Father's and Hideo's names to come out. Sure enough, if anyone has seen Kawashima Yoshio or his son Hideo or has information about them, contact Mr. Matsumura at his silk textile company, Morioka, Japan. We continued to make gift items and sell them after school, and every Saturday we made the trip to Mizuru with fresh name papers. In our bits of free time, Ko taught me how to make a blouse and skirt from the leftover materials the corporal sent. Life was a little easier. All I needed now was Father and Hideo. What was taking them so long? It was April. Cherry blossoms were in full bloom. Birds were singing their love songs in the cedar forest at the Mayoshinji Temple. Soon there would be a nest and family. Were Father and Hideo dead? If I knew they were dead, I would give up hope, but not knowing frustrated me. The school term ended, and I made straight A's. But I knew I would not be going to school anymore, for the tuition money had run out. I rushed to the furnace room to show my report sheet to Mr. Naito. You made it! Smiling, he pulled 3 yen from his billfold for cans he had sold and handed me 2 extra yen, congratulating me. Keep it up, he patted my back. He had been such a fierce friend to me, and he had no one else to talk to in the school. I could not tell him I was quitting. Miss Asada announced that the class was going to the flower viewing that afternoon, and everyone was excited. They were all stowing belongings and bags for vacation. I thought, what's such a big deal about going to see cherry blossoms? I had no space in my heart for such frolicking. I had more important things to do. And I had a new worry besides the struggle to live. My eyes. I could not see the teachers writing on the blackboard. I also had a hard time hearing the soft-spoken teachers. I asked permission to be excused from going to the flower viewing, using as an excuse Ko's university-style show, which I said I wanted to see. But I did not go to the style show. I went from door to door displaying our wares. Each time I made a sale, I put the money in the small bag Ko had made and put it in my inside trouser pocket. I rushed home in time to fix supper for Ko. With better weather, she stayed on the street to polish shoes and hurried home just before 6 so we could listen to the radio. Then she started supper. But tonight I wanted to have something good for us, maybe a fish. I had money from the cans and sales in Mr. Naito's gift. At the general store, I bought a fish, and with my 1 remaining yen, I bought 2 tea bags. With this tea, I should celebrate with Honorable Sister my good report sheet. At the stream, I scaled the fish. Soft green dandelion leaves were shooting up from the soil, and I left the fish wrapped in a large bamboo leaf and went back with a bucket and peeling knife. I had gotten much more skillful in building a fire in the small stone-ringed fireplace. I put the bucket of water on the fire with the dandelions in it, but the greens shrank so much that I fished them out and went back with the bucket for more. As I turned to go back to the fireplace, through the glass doors of the factory, I saw a man walking by. He was carrying a burlap bag on his hips in Korean fashion, and I remembered how Mr. and Mrs. Lee used to carry their belongings that way when they were not carrying things on their heads. For a while, I dreamed of happy bygone days. Again, I went back for dandelions, and again, as I returned, the young man passed, walking slowly toward the general store. Perhaps he's a Korean who's not familiar with this area, I thought. Maybe he cannot speak Japanese and can't find what he's looking for. Perhaps I can help him. But first I had to find a skewer for the fish and lay it across the stones and squeeze greens. Then I stepped out to the front of the warehouse. He had turned and was coming back. Beyond the warehouse were only open fields, no house or person for him to find. He stood, then walked toward me. "Good evening," he called in perfect Japanese. I waited for him to come nearer so I could see and hear him clearly. "Oh, little one, little one!" He was rushing toward me. I stood there, half in shock, and then I cried out and threw myself into his arms. "Welcome home, honorable brother." That night, as dark enveloped our humble sleeping place, I made 3 beds, one for Hideo to rest as well. As I lay in mine, I saw the stars shining like petals of white chrysanthemums. For the first time since I had left Nanam, I felt their loveliness, and each star that sparkled was like great fireworks in the enormous sky for the gladness of our reunion.